Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call this remote hearing of the Legacy Finance Committee meeting to order. I'd like to start off with our clerk, Mr. O'Neill. Would you be willing to take our role, please?
Of course, Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lilly present. Representative Jordan.
Jordan present.
Representative Jordan present. Representative Green.
Present.
Representative Green, present. Representative Acomb.
Present.
Representative Acomb, present. Representative Anderson.
Anderson, present.
Representative Anderson, present. Representative Bowe.
Bowe, present.
Representative Bowe, present. Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Christensen, present. Representative Hassan. Representative Murphy.
Murphy, present.
Representative Murphy, present. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, present.
Representative Nelson, present. Representative Erdahl.
Present.
Representative Erdahl, present. Representative Wazlowick.
Wazlowick, present.
Representative Wazlowick, present. Representative Zhang.
Zhang, present.
Representative Zhang, present. Representative Lilly, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, we have a quorum. We're open for business. Vice Chair Jordan, would you be willing to move the minutes from the March 6th meeting? Have you had an opportunity to peek at them?
I did, but I'm going to move the minutes from March 16th, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I don't. What did I say?
So moved. They look great, Sam.
Okay, I don't even know what I said. So thank you, Vice Chair Jordan. Any questions to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 The minutes have been approved. Thank you. So, morning, Representative Keel. We have some folks from your area that need a little help with the extension, and so we invited you. And it was nice to hear your story this morning, and you know what's going on, but. So we have House File 2933, and it's in regards to your Central Park, and you need an extension. So Representative Keel, good morning, and please introduce yourself and tell us about your bill and what you're working on.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I thank you very much. Yes, House File 2933 is to help our local park in Crookston, Minnesota. The Central Park has been I was even a child in band, playing in the bandstand, and so it's always been a central part of our community. But we have our city administrator and people that work on this in Kirsten, and I would really like them to introduce the bill if we could do that.
So thank you, Representative Keel. And before we transition, I'll move. The chair will move that House File 2933 be laid over for possible inclusion. So, Representative Keel, we have your bill before us. And so you want Ms. Finch, I believe?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Finch, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your, when you're ready. I love your split screen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, committee members, for joining us today. And we do have part of our team with us, our engineer, our Parks and Rec Director, Public Works Director, and our finance team. I'm going to give you a little bit of a brief history. So in 2018, we were awarded a grant to improve our campground and bathhouse in our Central Park here in Crookston through the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission. We are done with design, and when we went out for bid, with many things that we're seeing right now with material delays and material costs, we actually came in about $813,000 over the grant budget that was developed in 2018 as part of the application. Even with our city's match, that left about $470,000 that would still need to be covered. The initial deadline was, I believe, June of 22. I have that here for me. We are asking for an extension to get us through a completion date of June of 2024. After talking with our contractors and our engineer, with material delays, cost of materials, even if we went out to bid again today, which is our intent to work with the grant administrator to rescope the project to try to get that adjusted so that we can actually complete the project within the grant budget that has already been developed and with the city match that is in reserves now. If we went out to bid today, the contractors were not confident that they could in fact meet a deadline or completion date of June 2023. So our request then is to extend the deadline to the June 2024 completion date to allow us time to work with our grant administrator to see what can be done to rescope the project, go back out for bid, and hopefully this time we are hopeful that material prices will settle down. Now with fuel prices, we just don't know how that's going to impact, but gives us a little bit more time to work on that and try to get this project through. It'll be bid out in two pieces. One will be a bathhouse improvement, and the other is for the campground and infrastructure with some electrical updates and gravel pads, so those things. So our request is simple, just a little bit more time to hopefully let the delays with material and costs come down a little bit, and based on feedback from our contractors and engineers to actually get this project completed. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members? I don't see it this time. Thank you for bringing this. We realize that there's a few of these that need to be tweaked, and we're gonna, there's support on both sides of the aisle to help people finish these projects successfully. And, they're just, there's a lot of things that you mentioned in your discussion with whether that's COVID or the costs related to projects are certainly increasing. So we're happy to do our part. Many of us have been up in your community because many of us also serve on capital investment. Have a couple of chairs on here, Representative Murphy and Representative Erdahl, and they've taken us on journeys through your beautiful town there on the, but Representative Keel, any comments, final things you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I appreciate you looking at this. This is important to the area, a wonderful place for gathering, and actually I don't know if we mentioned it, but sometimes these parks are used for people who come in and work harvest time and will camp while during harvest. So it's economically and otherwise important for the community of Crookston. I really appreciate you considering this. So thank you very much for considering this project.
Thank you, Representative Keel. And I'll renew my motion that House File 2933 be laid over. And so, Representative Keel, your bill is laid over. Thank you, and we'll definitely work to include that in our final product. Thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So we're going to shift gears a little bit to our folks with the Parks and Trails area. And Ms. Madsen, do you want to kick us off? Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Lilly, committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. I'm coming to you from a beautiful downtown Austin rather than my typical Duluth where I'm based out of. We have a commission meeting this morning at one of our 67 designated facilities, which is the J.C. Hormel Nature Center. So I apologize, but after we're done here, I'll be dashing out the door to get set up for that meeting. So thanks for your time this morning to talk about our extension. This would be for the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund partners. It's our coordination among partners dollars that we're asking for the extension for 2 years for today. Like so many individuals, organizations, Crookston, of course, one of our other designated facilities, COVID has been difficult to complete projects, and this two-year extension will certainly help us catch up from some projects and complete them. Part of the delay for hiring our Parks and Trails Legacy Coordinator to the committee was a two-year hiring freeze. So that project, of course, got delayed, which set funds aside. And some of the other projects that we're working on but have been delayed are pretty exciting. We've been exploring a partner's project around statewide trails, a north-south route and an east-west route. And this project would bring together all three partners' trails because, as we've talked about before, no one cares where one trail starts, one in council's trail starts, and another one picks up. So this would be a seamless system that we've been working on with that committee to provide some suggestions for rides. I know, Chair Lilly, this would be of great interest for you. Market that opportunity. As well, we've been working with Sue Jens at the State Arts Board to get some guidance about art in our parks and on our trails. So an exciting project that we're kicking off is the three agencies working together to do an inventory of what public art exists in our parks with an outside agency, and also doing training for those managers of the parks and trails about their art and taking care of it and properly maintaining it. So it's an effort that we're going to be doing to make available to everyone with art in their parks to make sure that we're properly maintaining these beautiful pieces of artwork that we have. So we've been working hard collaboratively, and I think, Chair Lilly, also you'll appreciate this. We're working on a collaborative piece to talk about the benchmarks between the three agencies and showing what's been accomplished with legacy funds over these past several years. And at the start of the next year's legislative session, we will have that joint report for you, modeled, as you've asked, somewhat after the commission's report that talks about the benchmarks that we've made, with lots of good stories about what's happening in the system. So that's also a project that would be used with these fund extensions. So we appreciate your time and attention, and I'm going to turn this over to my colleague at Metropolitan Council, Lisa Barajas, to talk about another exciting joint research project that these funds are being used for and the extension would help with. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Madsen, and thank you for listening to our committee and incorporating, you know, a variety of the funds and kind of efforts. And I think Chair Murphy's and all of us have kind of expressed interest in trying to do that. Thank you very much for listening. I'm excited to see how you bring that through. Ms. Barras, good morning. Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Lisa Barajas, Executive Director of Community Development at the Metropolitan Council. Really pleased to be with you this morning. I'm not in my typical location in the Twin Cities. I'm actually up in Grand Marais in a cabin where I think we're snowed in today. We got a lot of snow last night. Unless the plow guy comes, we're just going to enjoy the scenery. But I wanted to talk to you. Yes. I wanted to talk to you about an exciting project that we have amongst the partners, the Council, Metropolitan Council, the DNR, and the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission. Hearing from legacy committee members in the past and thinking about how we share our data and track visitation amongst our system across the state of Minnesota has been really difficult. We all have sort of different sources and different ways of doing that, and not all the same resources. And we thought this would be an excellent project to do together. So this project is developing a common research methodology using location-based services data to analyze visitation to state and regional parks and trails. It's a type of analysis that we've started to do in the Twin Cities on our own regional park system, and using a methodology that we've been using in transportation planning with Minnesota Department of Transportation in the Twin Cities for the last several years, on really getting a sense of where people are going and where they're coming from. So this data is showing really significant promise in providing data valid at the park level, the level at which many planning and programming decisions are made. While this doesn't take the place of in-person survey work, we'll continue to do that. That type of work can reveal the nuances of why people are visiting or what features are most attractive to them. The promise of this new project is being able to more consistently and accurately assess parks visitation across the entire state of Minnesota at a much more affordable price and at a much more regular pace on an annual basis. We'll be able to tell you what's happening and even be able to tell you more accurately about the impacts of COVID rather than what we're seeing at this point is mostly anecdotal because we have to be in person to see that. But location-based services data really gives us the opportunity to not have to be everywhere in order to count how many folks are actually visiting our parks and trails. So really excited about that and happy to stand for any questions you might have this morning. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this work.
Well, thank you. Sounds like you're in a wonderful place. We often have a question on counting. And is there a mechanism, and I've never really had the answer to this, and people ask it, to answer double counting. Sometimes I wonder, like as I do ride a bike, like in the metro, if I ride around a lake, would that count me 3-4 times, perhaps?
Mr. Chair, committee members, certainly in the past, if we were in person, you might have been counted by an in-person doing a survey as, you know, a separate user. With our location-based services data, it actually shows where people are coming from and then where they're going within the park, too. So we can get a little bit at an aggregate level, not an individual level. We won't ever be able to see Representative Lilly riding his bike 4 times around the lake. But we can see how long people spend in the park and as a group and what that average amount of time would be and then generally where they're coming from or where they're going to within the park itself.
Okay. So generally the reason we've invited these folks, the different groups today, is to have, they're working through our committee administrator to for extensions. And so there's a, obviously with Representative Keel, I mean, that was in a bill form, but others are working, on language to for extensions too. So that's kind of what mainly this visit is, to kind of explain what they're asking for. I see a hand from Representative Green. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was listening here, and I'm trying to figure out how is this location-based data work, and how is it really going to be gathered? Because the last statement that the testifier made, it sounds like someone's going to be standing there counting you. So I'd like to maybe have her explain a little more how she's going to gather the information, what it's going to be used for. Basically, how exactly are you going to track the people?
Ms. Barras.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I apologize for any confusion. We actually purchased the data from data aggregators. So folks that collect that data on your cell phone, if you have your location-based services turned on your cell phone, the way that the data collectors, the Googles and such, sell that data is in aggregate. So they will sell the information, so you will never have any individual cell phone information, but rather we can track larger movements of groups of people from different zip codes into generalized areas, including our parks and along our trails, or like we do for transportation planning along transportation corridors. We can tell when more people are visiting, but we won't be able to know anything about individuals' travel. So this is the type of data that we purchase from larger companies, and then we only get it in aggregate form, not in individualized form.
Representative Green.
Thanks. So really, it really is not going to be very accurate data. For instance, if someone comes in with their family and they have one cell phone, or someone there's without a cell phone, you're really not going to be gathering great data, and you're going to be purchasing it. What's the cost?
Ms. Barras.
Mr. Chair, committee members, right now we don't get information on visitation to each of our parks and trails across the entire state of Minnesota. We're using estimates based on what we've seen and passed through in-person intercepts. and what we sometimes do with sampling on a kind of every couple of year basis, at least in the Twin Cities area. And I know Renee and our DNR partners can speak to some other sources they might use to estimate what we're getting for visitation. For the purposes of getting a better assessment, this won't be truly accurate. It's not going to be a perfect headcount. It will be better than what we have today, especially at the unit level. Right now, we're taking sample across our systems and then estimating what that will be for the other parts of the system that we may not have sampled as heavily or not as recently. We actually have a license to use the data. We don't get it like a, you know, purchase it once a year type of thing, but it's a license that we share through the state of Minnesota through the Department of Transportation. It's a pretty inexpensive license that we use at the council. I think it's less than $10,000. And so we have a considerable access to amount of information throughout the calendar year too for a number of different purposes for research and analysis, not just in parks and trails.
Representative Green.
Well, thanks, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to beat this, but I would like to see the current formula that you're using and the data that you're using. And then I was at I've sat in a lot of these meetings, and I was under the impression at one time in the metro area they actually had counters set up. So as people went by, they would count those people. I think that's what I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think that's what the chair was talking about. On the question that I've asked many times, how many people get counted? Do you use those counters as estimates?
Ms. Barras. You're mute.
I apologize.
All good. We've all done it.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and committee members. We do continue to do in-person counting, and we do that on a less frequent basis because it is a significant cost. It's about $500,000 to do that sort of intensive in-person counting. We don't, because of the cost of that and the people power that is needed to do that sort of counting, we're not able to be in every location at every time to do those counts. And we do that counting about every 5 years because of the cost and the extensiveness of that sort of in-person sort of count. In the interim years, we're using other sorts of information to do estimates and working with our local partners. Now, I know in for Greater Minnesota and for DNR, that there are different methodologies that they use that's going to be a little bit different than the council. So one of the benefits of this project is to have us all using a similar methodology in order to be able to compare across the system.
Thank you. It looks like Ms. Madsen has something to contribute. Ms. Madsen.
Chair Lilly, thank you. If I could, I would just also mention that this ability to have this study through our coordination with partners dollars is really a huge game changer for our 67 facilities in Greater Minnesota. We don't have any sort of standardized counting because we don't own or operate these particular facilities, partners do. So for us to be able to get counting on the same footing as the Metropolitan Council and Minnesota DNR, this is an amazing, amazing project for us. So our partners are excited. Our 67 facilities are thrilled to be able to have a good baseline information for what they're doing. And the ability to reach back from 2018 to 2022 and look at the visitor patterns is just an amazing, exciting project for us. And you'll have this information when all of this is done. We're going to be very excited to share it with everyone. So this project really is indicative of something that could never happen in Greater Minnesota without the ability to have these dollars and hire a researcher to do this important work for us.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Just one more thing. I got interrupted there for a little bit, so I apologize for that. But I would like to have the information on what you're collecting. And maybe if you've been collecting, even doing those counts every 5 years, maybe going back however many years, 15, 20 years, and seeing what the counts are, and then the other data that you were talking about that you're using to run your estimates. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for the discussion. Since we've kind of gone down this path, I would be interested in, as we gather data that we're trying to reach some of our new users trying to figure out to make sure that they're, you know, maybe we're already, you know, on a high level of achievement, but maybe we might find there's gaps or, you know, maybe almost it seems like instead of just data, we almost need like some of that in-person stuff to see what we could do to enhance our products. But that's just that's the marketing side of me to that, you know, just to make sure that we're making people feel welcome and, you know, that, you know, just to be all inclusive if we can. So that would be kind of my addition to, yes, the numbers are good, but I'd also like to make sure our product is meeting the future. So any other questions from members? Seeing none, Ms. Barras and Ms. Madsen, thank you for coming this morning. We the extension language, just to be clear, is it's posted for reference, you know, for folks to look at. And but also, if you have questions or you have other extension needs for folks that are listening, please reach out to our committee and make sure that you get that before the, you know, so we can attach it to the bill. So thank you, folks from the Parks and Trails, and enjoy the up north and enjoy Austin. Both, it's a funny mix. So you're both each one different directions. So switching gears here, Mr. Kelleher, we're going to switch to Historical Society folks, and they also have the need of an extension. So Mr. Kelleher. Go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. Thanks for taking a couple of minutes this morning to discuss our request for extension of legacy funds for history projects. Thanks again for the time that the committee spent earlier, and I hope earlier this session, I hope you all had a chance to take a look at the report that we distributed to the committee members. And if anyone needs a copy of the report, I'm happy to drop it off at your office. The report describes all the different activities that we've undertaken in the history area with legacy funds over the last year. So thank you for the great support, and we're very proud of the work that's been done with those funds in the history area. Today, I want to talk about some challenges that we've had. We're not alone, of course, in having the twin challenges of public health emergency and economic challenges that have gone together. Due to closures of our facilities, historic sites, museums, and our library and the History Center, and a resulting loss of revenue, particularly in 2020, but also extending into 2021, we lost a significant amount of revenue from admission sales and other fees. So as a result, we have lost staff and much of our activity has slowed down. We've been unable to move as quickly as we would like on some of the projects that Minnesota Historical Society has undertaken overall, but with legacy funds in particular. Some examples would include with legacy funds, we provide assistance for schools that may not be able to afford the transportation costs for a field trip to historic sites and museums. We assist with those efforts to bring kids to the History Center to see exhibits and historic sites across the state to visit and learn about Minnesota history. Schools were not doing field trips over the past 2 years, so that has virtually stopped, so we were unable to spend the funds for assisting school groups for that initiative. Similarly, we develop educational programs for students and for educators to make them effective educators with curriculum in Minnesota history. I don't have to tell you all that educators have had their plates full over the last 2 years, so getting input and working with educators to create educational programs has slowed down as well. And in the library world, the Minnesota History Center has the Gale Family Library, where History Day students, researchers, academics are able to access various collections. That area was closed for a time, and our staff was responding to requests online. So some efforts to improve library systems also slowed down during this period. So there are numerous others, and I'll kind of quit there, but Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we really would appreciate some extra time to complete these projects wisely, and really appreciate the assistance of staff to have an amendment that's in your packet that would accomplish this, the A3 amendment. So Mr. Chair, fairly simple language in the amendment, and with that, I'm very happy to answer any questions that committee members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. I see a hand, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kelleher, I have three questions or so here. One is, you stated that it was more difficult with legacy funds, and you stated why it was difficult with legacy funds, but what is the difference between the other funding that you get, and why is the legacy more difficult?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, we have a mix of a lot of different kinds of funds. The revenue that we receive from, say, admissions doesn't have the time factor on it. Legacy funds expire at a certain point in time, so that's the time nature. So if we receive, you know, X dollars from admission revenues or sales revenues, those are not bound by time the way Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars are.
Representative Green.
Thank you for that. That leads into my next question then. You know, you can't roll back the clock and change what happened. So you've got that money there, and if we do give the extension, then you're going to have that money moving into the future. What are you going to still be coming back for additional funding then, or using what you've got on hand?
Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, appropriations have been made for fiscal year 22-23, and we hope to be able to spend all of those. Some of the projects that we're working on with previous appropriations, like fiscal year 21, are underway but need a little bit more time to be completed. Similarly, fiscal year 22-23 projects are also underway, and we'll work toward the deadlines of when those funds expire in the future, and we'll play catch up. We'll just have to work hard to play catch up to meet those future deadlines. But this is an unusual time. We know how these funds work with expiration dates, and we adhere to those, but this is a very unusual time that things have slowed down, and we just haven't been able to use the funds as quickly as we had hoped.
Representative Green.
Well, just one more kind of question, kind of comment. If the funds are there, and now with the stuff going on in the Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts, it doesn't look like anything's going to open up all that soon with the schools again. So you're still going to have a build up there where maybe you're not going to be able to expend these funds. And so I'm hoping that you put something in place where if these funds aren't spent and you're asking for extensions, that maybe in the next year you'll be able to use them moving forward instead of just banking them and ending up with a bunch of stuff that maybe who knows what the future is. You know, so keep that in mind as you're looking at this, and hopefully you don't be like most government entities that just say we need to spend this money because it's here, instead of really looking for good projects.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green,
Mr. Keller, yep.
Two thoughts on your last comment. One is the good news is when I walk from the History Center up to the Capitol. Once or twice a day, I have seen school buses at the History Center, and kids running in and running out, and that is music to our ears when those kids are coming to the History Center. So they're coming back. We get kids from all over the state at the History Center. So certainly the slowdown in Minneapolis might mean a little bit fewer kids coming from that school district, but we get kids from all over the state. And they're coming back, and it's great to see the yellow school buses next to the History Center. What we don't want to do is just say we're going to quickly spend the money to meet a deadline. We want to spend these dollars wisely. We want to take our time and do these projects the right way, and your assistance to do that would be appreciated.
Representative Green.
No, that's fine, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Thank you. Had my first student group come back to the Capitol the other day, and that is a historical site, the Capitol. And I got to tell you, it was just fantastic just to have the kids and watch their eyes. You know, we're all so blessed to work in this magical place, and it's just been, you know, going through the renovation and COVID, but to see the kids, and it is the people's house. It's just I think what Mr. Kelleher said, just to see the buses and the kids, and you know, it was really neat. So thank you, Mr. Kelleher. I know you're always available for questions, and appreciate your coming this morning, and we'll do what we can. Please, if you have additional changes you need, make sure you get them to Mr. Molzon, and we're happy to help. So have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Really appreciate it.
So we're going to switch gears. We have an extension that we need for our Ash River and St. Louis County folks. And so welcome this morning. And I'm certain I'm going to butcher this. Mr. here goes, Djokovic.
You did.
Not even close.
Fantastic. Fantastic work. I have been called so much worse.
Well, welcome. It's great to have you, and please go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I really appreciate the time today, and you did really well. That automatically makes you an honorary ranger. So my name is Mike Djokovic, and I serve on both the St. Louis County Commission and a member of the Voyageurs National Park Clean Water Joint Powers Board, and that's something we're very, very proud to be part of. Thank you for hearing this amendment language today and for considering our request to extend this 2017 appropriation. Voyageurs National Park is the nation's only water-based national park, with more than 84,000 acres of water and 134,000 acres of land. So we've got quite the place, and again, very proud. The interconnected waterways of the park provide an unparalleled opportunity to explore the Northwoods Lake Country. It is gorgeous. We invite everybody to come up and check us out. If you haven't been here, you're missing out. Unfortunately, those waters are being negatively affected by human impacts, such as wastewater generation and disposal from existing developments throughout the region. The water quality degradation threatens the long-term health of the ecosystem and the economic health of the tourism industry upon which the local economy is actually based. So very conscientious of that. The Voyageurs National Park Clean Water Joint Powers Board is a collaboration between Kuching and St. Louis counties and was established to address the need for improved wastewater treatment in the area. In 2010, Voyageurs National Park Joint Powers Board prepared comprehensive water plan. The plan outlined our four major areas, which are also major access points to Voyageurs National Park. Since completion of the progressive comprehensive watershed plan, the Joint Powers Board has been able to secure over $25 million in grants for projects in the area. Projects were completed at Crane Lake and Pucks Point on Lake Captogama. A large project at Island View is currently under construction, and the project at Ash River is in report phase. So we're moving right along. Our request today is to extend for 1 year 2017 appropriation for the Ash River phase. A public hearing on the facility plan was just held in February. The recommended alternative in the facility plan was a community collection and treatment system with subsurface dispersal. Readying the project for bidding, soil exploration, site survey, and final design will need to be completed. These tasks were initially to be completed by this time. However, due to COVID, we were not able to meet with stakeholders as often as we needed to get input on the project. The extension and remaining grant dollars will provide for engineering services to prepare final design documents. Thank you for your support and consideration, and look forward to working with all of you in our clean water efforts. So again, thank you so much for your time. If you have any questions, I'll try and field whatever I can for you. But again, it's been an honor to come before you today and tell you a little bit about our project that we are very, very proud of.
Thank you, sir. And any questions, Representative Green or Representative Murphy, any questions for our testifier this morning or presenter? Representative Green.
Not for me, I guess. I was looking over the project and I can see their point, I guess.
And I don't have any questions either, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you both.
So it's my commissioner. I don't have any.
I thought Representative Murphy, we got to get her out there in a canoe, I think, and trying some.
Oh, no, I've had enough canoes.
Okay. Representative Erdahl, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just wondering what the status of some of these things are in the Senate. Are they going to be doing any of these types of projects?
Representative Erdahl, I've had an opportunity, and our staff, Mr. Molzon's had an opportunity to visit with Chair Rood and the Senate's. My understanding is they're open to the extension, certainly, for meeting the needs of COVID and some of the cost overruns. And, you know, I mean, it's just, there's definitely, my understanding is agreement on this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's what I wanted to know. I mean, are we just spinning our wheels with some of these things, or is there actually something that can happen if the Senate is going to act? So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. No, these are very vibrant, and you know, they'll be joining with the Bassard Sam's bill as it moves through, and you know, very, very likely to pass. I mean, we can't guarantee anything in our business, but
Mr. Chair, briefly, we are on yes, our sir. End. We are working with the Senate and have support of Senator Bach with trying to get this done. So we're working on our end, and we're doing everything we can to try and get this thing over the finish line. Again, thank you so much for your time today. Come and visit us. Come and visit and see exactly what we're talking about. You may never want to leave.
Well, we had a presenter earlier that was up in your Pulse, yes. Grand Marais, so that's
another large body of water that's pretty well known.
Well, thank you very much, sir, and enjoyed your presentation this morning, and we're happy to do what we can to help you, sir.
Thank you. Everyone take care. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye.
So we're going to switch gears again, and we've invited Mr. Gardner with the Clean Water. He's a clean water administrator and, you know, works on the Clean Water Council. And as you all know, one third of our funds are, you know, 33% are going to clean waters. And I think, you know, we've kind of, we're allowed to do a deeper dive into some of the work that's done in the Lasard Sams and some of the other funds. And I just really think it's important to spend a little bit more time taking a deeper dive into some of the and successes and, you know, perhaps if there's some needs that need to be addressed on the clean water side. So, Mr. Gardner, welcome. Good morning. Please introduce yourself and go ahead. You're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just checking my audio here.
Sounds great.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council. The Clean Water Council, as I think members know, is a state advisory council created by the Clean Water Legacy Act. And then it recommends how to spend the Clean Water Fund every 2 years. We're currently about to start our recommendations process for fiscal 24 and 25. Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to mention that the some members of the Clean Water Council had a chance in September on the most beautiful Minnesota weather day ever to tour sites by Voyageurs National Park. Just as an aside, I took one of the MPCA's electric vehicles and went all the way to Voyageurs National Park with it and got back. It was fine. But we had a chance to understand the complexity of this project. And well, its own project rather than going through our regular programs, it is the kind of project that we like because it the Clean Water Fund is really the first dollar on the table, which allows other state, federal, and local funds to be placed on the issue of keeping bacteria and other sewage out of the lakes at Voyageurs National Park. And I, when asked, well, the way I would characterize the value of the project is the Clean Water Fund makes all those complex projects more shovel-ready faster. They wouldn't be able to do it as quickly. So we're very impressed to see how everybody's working on, under very challenging geological conditions because there's not a lot of soil there. It's right on top of the rock, and it just makes traditional on-site sewage a difficult thing. Mr. Chair, I know that you have all sorts of constraints, and sometimes things pop up at the last second, like caucus meetings. So if you have to give me the hook, I will be glad to be thrown under the bus or whatever you need to do. But what I'd like to do today is just highlight a couple of projects that show how the Clean Water Fund is used to delist waters from our impaired waters list. The impaired waters list is something we give to EPA every 2 years to indicate the health of our waters. And it's this is really just one cross-section of things we do with the Clean Water Fund. And then I have one example where we're doing a hybrid where we have Clean Water Funded stuff combining with a regulatory approach to help deal with things in the Red River Basin, if time allows. And I have a sticky key. Here we go. The impaired waters list is something that's required by the US EPA. Every 2 years, the MPCA produces a draft biennial list of impaired waters. Impaired waters are waters that do not meet water quality standards. You have to have a water quality standard for a water to be impaired to measure against. I am just gratuitously using this image of suburban Ramsey County. My house is in this picture somewhere. To show you the state's Minnesota Impaired Waters Viewer. Anybody with a web browser can look at this data to figure out where, whether you have a local water that's impaired and for what. So if you were to put your cursor over Snail Lake, which is kind of at 12 o'clock here on the clock face of this map, you would see that it's impaired for mercury. Which, not by much, but it would mean there might be some restrictions on someone who's of childbearing age to eat fish out of that lake, or at least to limit their frequency. The purple indicates a lake that has been delisted. And in this case, Lake Owosso, which is down near the bottom, the big lake, that's been delisted for mercury pollutants. Mercury tends to come from the air, often from coal-burning power plants. And while the experts at the PCA remind me that correlation is not causation. We are seeing a lot of coal burning power plants shut down, which means less mercury in the air. So that's good. We test for more things in Minnesota in more places than other states. So it would follow that we actually have a lot of impairments to show compared to other states at times. The number of impaired waters is quite large. The reason that I wanted to bring this up is we recognize that there's always some shock every 2 years when the list comes out. When people see thousands and thousands of impaired waters, some are more harmed than others. Sometimes there's multiple impairments or just one, and sometimes it's an impairment that we can't do much about, like mercury. But the more we test, the more we find. The number of impairments, we believe, is going to start leveling off because the Clean Water Fund allowed monitoring, intensive monitoring, for all 80 watersheds in the state. And we test every 10% of them every year in a 10-year cycle. So it stands to argue that our impaired waters numbers go up by roughly 10% a year as we test more. But now that that's been done, We are starting to see some numbers look like they're going to level off. There have been some new contaminants added, like for sulfate water quality standards and PFAS, that caused new waters to be added to the list. But it is our belief that the number of impairments is going to be leveling off. And then as we deploy more of the Clean Water Fund, we start to see a decline. I know with COVID that you're familiar with terms like lagging indicators. So, for example, if you were to look at hospitalization rates due to COVID, they're often referred to as a lagging indicator because someone's been infected and then they don't feel well, and then finally they feel so bad that they go to the hospital. So it's a lagging indicator of infections. In the case of impaired waters, delisting a water is a lagging indicator of success. Long after the Clean Water Fund and the Legacy Amendment expire, if you just assume that it just expires in 2034, there will be waters that will come off the impaired waters list after that, because the work will have been started before the expiration, but the trend data that we need over several years to prove that it's actually working wouldn't happen till after. So we would expect improvement long after that. Just to give you a very quick overview of how we actually try to remove impairments from our water, I have in plain language, in larger font, what we do, followed by smaller fonts for our official government water lingo here. We test the water to figure out what's wrong with it, try and find the source of the problem, train people how to solve the problem, make a plan to fix the problem, set aside land where necessary if it's in a vulnerable area, restore waters with things like lakeshore restorations, stream restorations, and the like, and then measure to see if we've actually accomplished our goal. That whole process of those six or seven bullet points can take a decade or more, as I'll show you in a minute. And as Bowser, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, like to say, in order to have success, you need to have the state funding, but also local leadership. And that usually is in the form of a watershed district or a soil and water conservation district, or a municipality or county, depends on the situation. Just to show you the precision that we try to use in planning, where we measure twice and cut once, as I like to say, we have watershed management plans that actually calculate using the science what type of best management practices have to be used to get to the water quality goals and by when. And we even have an estimate, generally speaking, of what it's going to cost to do that, and have a checkoff list of all the projects that would need to take place and where. That shows up in places like Chisago Lakes. This is where we've seen some recent delistings for phosphorus in the dark blue lakes. Mr. Chair, when I served in the House, I was told that this was called the Swedish Riviera. I hope that isn't causing any ancient animosities with you. I know you're a Norwegian. I hope enough time has gone by that things have settled down. Anyway, you know, over the course of a decade, the Chisago Soil and Water Conservation District received several grants from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, from the Clean Water Fund, which helped bring in some federal money and some local matching funds to implement practices in the hundreds with 43 different landowners. These were things done in town and in the countryside. There was no one project that actually made the difference to help it get delisted for phosphorus. It was a combination of activities. So in town, it can include things like rain gardens. If you're in a, you know, I don't live in this area, but if I lived, say, in the center city, but away from the lake, a rain garden might help reduce the amount of stormwater runoff and sediment loss, and therefore phosphorus that ends up in the lake. Lakeshore property owners were encouraged and incentivized to restore shorelines to reduce erosion and do things like native plants. Farmers were encouraged to use things like cover crops and other ways to avoid bare soil when the cash crop wasn't growing. And the phrase we often use here is move dirt. There were examples of things like water and soil control or sediment control basins or WASCOBs put in to allow sediment to settle out so it didn't end up in a local stream and then into the lake. So a combination of all of those things over about a decade, verified through several monitoring data sets, allowed these two lakes to be taken off the impaired waters list. We're we don't delist everything. The number of delisted waters in the state of Minnesota is still in the double digits, but the number of places where we're trying to make improvements is in the hundreds. Another example here, and I don't mean to just single out Greater Minnesota here, because we do deploy lots of money in the metro area, as I know you were aware, Mr. Chair. But here we have an example, and maybe I'm just pandering to Representative Erdahl here. The Clearwater River Watershed District in Meeker, Stearns and Wright counties. This is where Lake Augusta and Union Lake were delisted for phosphorus as well. Again, no one project made the difference, but you can see the before picture on the upper left with lots of red. That is where lakes are not meeting a clarity standard, meaning there's too much phosphorus, which means there's too much stuff growing in the lake to decrease clarity. And then on the bottom, you see a more recent depiction of where water quality is at, and a lot of the red has been removed. This is good. This was done through a combination of urban stormwater management and rural conservation, everything from converting row crops to pasture land, working with farmers to be more precise in how much nitrogen fertilizer they're using. There are several tools we have, like, again, moving dirt, like a limestone filter or a pre-treatment basin where water is allowed to settle and let the contaminants settle out. And then in cities, particularly in Kimball, everything from wetland restoration and rain gardens to infiltration basins helped water settle out before it could get into local lakes. The Clean Water Funds helped attract federal money as well to I wouldn't say it was doubling all your impact, but it was magnifying our impact or multiplying our impact. And this is all due to multiple grants from the Board of Water and Soil Resources from the Clean Water Fund. Mr. Chair, I was going to leave with this slide. There are some examples where we use regulation to do things and other areas where we provide funding and expertise to solve problems, because maybe regulation wouldn't apply or it doesn't exist. So in agriculture, for example, or urban stormwater. This is a picture of Lake Winnipeg in Canada. This is an algal bloom seen from space, fueled in part by phosphorus that comes from the Red River. And obviously that drains from Minnesota and North Dakota, and a tiny bit of South Dakota. As you may know, municipalities require a waste or a effluent permit. Wastewater treatment plants treat our sewage and then put the cleaned water back into a river or other body of water, and they need a permit to do that from the MPCA. We have had a great success story with a lot of wastewater treatment plants reducing a lot of phosphorus that ends up in our major rivers over the last 20 years. That has been a great success. Bonding, state bonding has been responsible for a lot of that. But there is a point in which to at which you need to meet a water quality standard by reducing phosphorus even further. And that's when the expense starts to go up. And so the cost per pound of phosphorus starts to increase the closer you get to the desired goal. You know, you can get rid of 80 and 90% of the problem without a whole lot of money, but to get the last bit costs a lot. Municipalities, understandably, have been concerned about this for many years. So the MPCA is creating some flexibility in 5 municipal wastewater treatment permits to not just say you have to reduce phosphorus by a certain amount only at the plant, but now they have the flexibility to work with landowners upstream to reduce their phosphorus runoff by the equivalent amount, so that we actually get the same result of better water quality, but do it more cheaply and with more flexibility. And we get more projects checked off upstream, particularly with farmers, for projects that we might not have funded with the dollars we had available. So it's a little bit like a cap and trade system for air emissions, except it's for water. So these cities may pay landowners to employ best management practices on their land, everything from cover crops to some land conversion to reducing inputs. The thing about the Clean Water Fund here is that the Clean Water Fund has made a lot of this idea possible by having accurate monitoring data. We always get asked about why we spend money on monitoring all the time. The reason is we have accurate data so that the folks who are calculating these permits and what effluent limits have to be met, they have accurate data that allows them to be more precise so that we're not just guessing. And when you guess and you're not very accurate, that can be more expensive. The planning work, like One Watershed, One Plan, the comprehensive watershed management plans that give you the list of projects that have to be done and their likely impact, and the watershed restoration protection strategies that the PCA does based on all the good science, and the expertise we have at the PCA on water credit trading, as well as the expertise of our local government partners, really helps all this happen. And so these are not tangible projects that you can see. It's expertise, it's monitoring, it's data, it's planning that has been paid for by the Clean Water Fund. We've already paid for it. Now we can employ it to allow these permits to be more flexible and get a better result for less money. So we've invested in those assets, Mr. Chair and members, so that we could save money down the road. I'm going to leave it there. I know that I ran right up to my limit the last time I was here, so if anyone had any questions from that or needed to rake me over the coals or grill me or fry me or whatever, I'm right here. Oh, my gosh, look at the hands.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. And are the one plans, are they funded by legacy dollars?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. The One Watershed, One Plan line item in the legacy finance bill supports the development of comprehensive watershed management plans for each of the 80 major watersheds in the state. They're not all complete yet, but it helps local stakeholders prioritize what projects to do first with the money that we have, using data and expertise at the state, which is also paid for by the Clean Water Fund.
So we have
lots of plans, Mr. Chair. I'm afraid there's like a dozen categories of plans, but the One Watershed, One Plan was designed to get rid of a lot of plans and have one big plan per watershed.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. And that was definitely a focus of this committee early on in the years, was to focus more on studies. And then there was a wave of us. We were kind of saying, well, okay, enough studies. We've got enough studies, time to hit the ground. And I know that you've transitioned into getting on the ground and doing things. I see a couple hands. I don't know. I think I'll start with Representative Anderson. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And good morning, Mr. Gardner.
Good morning.
We're a member of the Paul Caucus in the House. Good to see you this morning. Our numbers are shrinking. But anyway, Mr. Gardner, you mentioned that you're on kind of a 10-year cycle in terms of checking some of these water bodies that have been put on the impaired list. So a couple of questions. Once a body is put on that list, does it take 10 years to get off the list, or could like a lake association do its own testing and try to get off that list sooner than that 10-year cycle you mentioned?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, nice to see you. Yes, so it's a 10-year cycle. So once every 10 years, each of the 80 watersheds has intensive monitoring, which is it's kind of like going to the Mayo Clinic to have a comprehensive check, as opposed to what a lake association might do with Secchi disc observations every year, which is more like a blood pressure check. The EPA will accept, I believe it is, two data sets within a five-year period that will allow you to see a trend to be able to take something off the list. And then once the PCA can confirm that, then they submit that on their massive spreadsheet to the EPA and say, we think this can be delisted because this lake has met whatever water quality standard that it was missing in the past. So yes, it can take when I say it takes a decade, I'm not actually talking about the monitoring. I'm saying it once they discover the problem, it can take a decade of projects to actually pay off. And as you know, you can only move dirt at certain times of the year or work with farmers during the growing season. So, we just can't do one big project like a wastewater treatment plan and be done. It takes multiple things over multiple years to do it. But I should say a third of the monitoring money we used to do for intensive monitoring has been cut back. So we don't actually do the same amount of monitoring to we used to. We now carve out about a third of it to respond to local partners. It could be an SWCD, it could be a lake association, it could be a state department who might say, we've just spent all this money on these projects on this lake. Can you tell us if it's working? Can you measure some more? So we're trying to target more of those monitoring resources away from just looking at the ambient nature of things to actually targeting evaluation to see if the money is working the way it's supposed to.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Well, example up in the Alexandria area, one of the lakes had a situation with the chloride, I think too much salt in the lake. And the MPCA came in and the folks up there said only took just a couple of samples or not very many and put it on the list in kind of a quick fashion. And now it's the label was there and it's going to be hard to get it off. And their question was the number of samples taken and was it a fair sample of the entire lake? How is the actual testing done? And is it MPCA that does most of the testing?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I'm a liberal arts grad, and so I may have to phone a friend who has far more scientific expertise, but there are, as my history major understanding appreciates it, rigorous protocols used for how they monitor, and so I would have to have someone get back to you on that. I will say just for the mechanics here, it only really takes one test to get on the impaired waters list. It takes two tests to get off the list, and that's an EPA thing. And so that that tends to cause that delay, that lagging indicator issue. But it does make sure that we're sure that something has come off the list. You know, and when it comes to chloride, we actually have a chloride reduction project funded by the Clean Water Fund in the past that has supported everything from smart salting training along with federal money to assisting communities that may have gone to central softening, but there may be a lot of residents that have timed water softeners, which are really inefficient, and try to persuade people either to or just understand whether they need a water softener or to switch to an on-demand system. It's like having a more, just like, it's like having a higher mileage vehicle that isn't idling all the time.
Yeah.
So.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gardner, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Green. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been asked by somebody on the committee to ask this next question, so I'll ask that now. First of all, Mr. Gardner, thanks for being here. Does the Clean Water Fund ever get used for land acquisition?
Mr. Chair and, Mr. And Representative Green, the Clean Water Fund rarely is used for a purchase. The only one I can think of offhand was in it was in Nobles County when a parcel came up for sale that happened to be right in a wellhead protection area that we saw in our recent field tour and Clean Water Fund was used to snatch that up. We do fund, we have funded off and on CREP to allow for major, for federal matching money and also for easements for particular parcels that are in a high priority area where we get a big bang for the buck. The number of acres that have been set aside in that way, it's in the thousands of acres, in less than 10,000, I think. I'd have to double check.
Representative Green.
Okay, then so back to the question, and I have a few questions, I will tell you.
Yes, sir.
Back to the question I was asked to ask. Now, the Clean Water Fund is never used for eminent domain. Correct.
Mr. Gardner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, I have watched the committee here a little bit and following the topic. I'm not aware of any, but that does not mean that we don't. Most of the money is used for voluntary efforts with willing landowners. Rather than any sort of regulatory setup, but I would certainly be happy to check for you and get back to you.
Representative Green.
I know that may not make you happy.
That's not a comforting answer, and I would like that information. Now I'm going to have to dig into the Clean Water Fund and see what he's doing more.
Well, so, I have learned never to say always or never unless I can prove it. So the answer may be we don't, but that's where I'm leaning, but I will definitely will check.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now to the real questions here. I followed the MPCA studies on the water for quite a number of years, and I've noticed a trend in them, and I'm wondering if you guys have noticed that as well, is that for the most part, and the last one that I looked at, almost every chemical is getting better on their list. The only one that really has not been doing so well is the chloride. And that obviously is for the world, probably in the metro area more than anything, but for the salt on the roads and stuff like that. And that's something that you're going to have to figure out how to handle. But what do you know, like, for instance, you talked about phosphorus, so we'll touch on that, and maybe nitrogen, because you mentioned nitrogen. What is the impact level where you start putting these lakes and rivers onto the impaired list?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, so you're correct. The overall level of phosphorus in our major rivers has been going down. The major reason for that is decades of excellent work and state funding, thank you, and federal money for wastewater treatment plants to reduce the amount of phosphorus they're putting out. So overall, the numbers are going in the correct direction. Nitrogen has been going up in selected parts of the state, and chloride has been going up. So I think you've been looking at our performance report that shows some of the general indicators or the nutrient reduction strategy. When it comes to some of these indicators, there isn't a one-size-fits-all number at times. There are deep lakes, there are shallow lakes, there are different soil types and the like. So they're accounting for local conditions for what the standard might be. So the water quality standard can vary. I think one complaint we've seen, which is being addressed by that Red River Basin project, is the municipality has said, why are you making us spend tens of millions of dollars to get a few pounds of phosphorus out? Senator Weber has a good rationale for that in this experience in Luverne. And so that's why there's some flexibility that we're looking at with support from the Clean Water Fund to allow other ways to reduce phosphorus, as an example, at a lower cost, and also check off some other things at the same time. But I have a feeling I didn't quite get the exact direct answer to your direct question, Representative Green.
Representative Green.
Thank you. And, you know, I know that if I keep on, we're going to run out of time, so I'm just going to say some things. I believe, as close as I can get an answer to it, that nitrogen and phosphorus actually occur naturally. Everyone knows that. You're not going into the lakes and removing phosphorus, and you're not going into the lakes and removing nitrogen. It actually, the waters will clean themselves if you stop putting it in. And so a lot of times the farmers get a bad rap on the nitrogen and the phosphorus, but the fact is that this stuff's going to be in the lakes, and I think that from what I can find, it occurs naturally at a rate of probably a little over 3 parts per million in the nitrogen. And so that's about the same gauge where they'll start putting the waters on the impaired list. And so the waters may be, you know, you could have very low amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus and other chemicals and still be impaired instead of contaminated. And I think that there's a real issue there that we need to bring out to people. The other issue is that in the phosphorus and nitrogen too, but mostly the phosphorus, because we're talking about that now, is that when they imposed the buffers, there was a study that came out of Canada, University in Canada, that studied the phosphorus in the plains regions. And in the low-lying regions where the ground is flat and you put these buffer strips on or even have vegetation where there is no farmland, that in the wintertime that all dies and it decomposes. And when the ground is frozen, the runoff carries that phosphorus into the stream. And so that in some cases, according to this study by the university, you would be better off doing some kind of tillage there that would stop the runoff from the decomposing grasses that are there. And I've asked before, and no one seems to want to do that here, but I think that's something that we need to look at. Also, we need to take a really closer look at our standards and what is occurring naturally. And then let people know that, like I said, it's, you know, we're spending a lot of money on this. In almost every case, the contaminant It's not contaminated. It's impaired. The impaired waters are improving right down the line. If you look at the list of waters and every time they're tested, it seems to get better. And not only that, when they do this to make their numbers look better, and I'm just going to say it plain, we have the technology now to actually measure this stuff in parts per trillion. Our impaired waters is based on parts per million, but now I see more and more that when they're testing, they're measuring it in parts per billion, and it looks like the numbers are higher. But if you look at those numbers, they're actually pretty low. And one way that it, in my way, kind of disguises that is they'll measure it in micrograms per liter instead of parts per billion, but they are the same thing. And I think that as we're spending this money, you take a much closer look at what is really out there and how much more we have to spend when we are increasing. And I'm going to end, I know there's other questions and we're getting late, so I'm going to end with this. For a number of years, we asked our farmers to cut back on nitrogen. And you know, you took some of the credit for that, but I think the credit belongs to them because not only did they spend a lot of money to do it, they now have the technology to do time release and also exactly how much they need. And so, you know, hats off to them for doing that. And that's one of the reasons you're seeing our waters get better. And so what has happened now is we've asked them to do this, and they have. They spent a ton of money, and it seems like a lot of times we're coming back and saying, now that's not enough. We want you to do more. And we need to be very careful of that because they're still, for no other reason than finances, they're still a huge part of our product in Minnesota. And not only that, they are our families. So, but anyway, Mr. Gardner, thank you for being here. Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to vent.
Thank you, Representative Green. I saw some nods on the farmer comment, and it seems like my observation that the Clean Water Council is making a good effort to work with folks, especially farmers, to be successful. So, and it sounds like they're very willing to help. Some of the articles I've read. Vice Chair Jordan, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Morning, everyone. Thanks for being here, Mr. Gardner. This is a partially foreign question, but it was something that was sparked in your presentation. So when we put, I know the United States and Minnesota have other laws about, we have international laws about water, specifically with our with other borders and other states. And obviously watersheds do not really care about the arbitrary political boundaries that we have created. They don't really care about anything because they're watersheds, they don't have brains. But I'm wondering about when we put a body of water, such as a lake or a river, on an impaired list, and that is within a watershed that goes into another state or another country, like for example, with Canada, the United States has a boundary waters agreement, and it's not named after the boundary waters, it's just named after the political boundary between the United States and Canada. So when we put a body of water on a list that flows into Canada, how does that impact other levels of law, including international and national law?
Mr. Gardner.
Great. I'd like to say that you're stumping me, but I have just enough information to work with. Well, interestingly, the state statute on the use of the Clean Water Fund says that it can only be used in Minnesota waters or the benefit of Minnesota waters, and it's kind of vague because we're at the top of watersheds, and so our water goes to Lake Superior, the Gulf of Mexico, and Lake Winnipeg and Hudson Bay. We actually do participate as a state in things like the Red River Basin Commission, which is the entity that is really pushed for overall reductions in those algal-producing phosphorus effluents that I mentioned in one slide. That's one of the drivers for why we're trying to come up with a flexible system. We are also participants in there's a hypoxia task force that EPA has, which it gets at the issue of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which is due in large part on nutrient runoff from here in the Midwest. And so we have a nutrient reduction strategy that lays out a framework for how we will reduce our inputs into the Gulf of Mexico And there's been a five-year report card that just came out, progress report, status report, showing where we're at. And I think that's maybe where Representative Green was reading some numbers. So we do participate in those. I wouldn't, I'm not skilled enough to say whether we are required to do anything because of those relationships, but we are a willing participant as a state of Minnesota, with the PCA usually being the lead in working with entities in other states as well as other countries. We're actually getting some federal money for the hypoxia task force from the federal infrastructure bill. It's not a whole lot. The Clean Water Fund dwarfs that amount by many times, but there's definitely an interest in figuring out how we reduce our inputs to the Gulf, to Lake Winnipeg, and to Lake Superior.
Vice Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gardner, for that answer. I always think it's important to remind Minnesotans that we're the headwaters of three different major watersheds in North America, and that's not something a lot of states can brag about, but it's something we can. So it's important that we are really taking that privilege seriously when it comes to clean water, because it is all our water. Even though we have it here in Minnesota, it does drain pretty much everywhere. So thank you for that answer. I'm glad that we're taking that into consideration.
And Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Mr. Gardner?
I would also add that we have some contaminants that come from outside Minnesota into Minnesota, mostly through the air. So, you know, we're all tied together.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. So I remember one time years ago, Lassard Sams, we put a carp dam in Iowa because we were worried about the carp coming into, and that was the most narrow place to, and that was quite controversial to actually buy a dam and or help buy a dam in Iowa. But it made the most sense to stop the movement into Minnesota. Representative Erdahl, good morning, and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gardner. You're still entitled to that title, by the way. Do you have any figures on what percent of our lakes and streams are impaired in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, first I was just going to mention about the interstate issue. We were asked to spend money during my tenure in the House on bird habitat in the Caribbean because those birds would winter there and come here. And I did receive a hit mailer at my house with little birds on it on a beach talking about how Representative Gardner was more interested in birds in the Caribbean than Minnesota. I can laugh about it now. Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, the off quoted figure I see is something like 56% of water is impaired. But I think that's for streams, but I can definitely get you the right number. For lakes, I would roughly 75% of our lakes are in good shape, which just means you can swim in it. We do have a goal of having 70% of our lakes being swimmable and 67% of our waters being fishable, using scientific data proxies to determine that. This number can both encourage and haunt people, depending on who you talk to. There is an admission that we can't solve every problem. There are some waters that are probably too far gone or are not high priority. With one watershed, one plan, the idea is to prioritize a lake, for example, that everyone likes to use, that you fish and swim in, but maybe not worry about another lake that is not used for anything. So there is an implicit acknowledgement that we can't fix everything and an explicit desire to prioritize lakes and streams that are of the highest priority. At the same time, the numbers I just mentioned about 67 and 70%, we're actually only within 6 or 7 percentage points of that now on the aggregate, if I recall our performance report correctly. So we're close. So others would say we're making good progress to getting to our goal. But it does frustrate some and me too that, we can't solve everything, but because we've altered our land, whether we've paved it or plowed it or developed it somehow, we know that that does result in lower water quality. We're not going to have a boundary waters type of situation everywhere. The question is how good do we have to get it for it to be fishable and swimmable? And even then, we know they're not going to get to everything, but we try and set priorities.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. It's nice to know that, you know, we are making some progress, and if there are metrics to measure that, I think that's good. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gardner.
I can send a link to Mr. Molzon with a couple of the key reports that he can distribute to the members afterwards.
Mr. Gardner, so in the East Metro here out towards the Stillwater, there's a lake that you'd almost maybe call it dangerous. Like Lily, actually, the lake's name is kind of funny. Lily Lake in Stillwater. Is there lakes like, how many of those are like in Minnesota are actually dangerous?
Mr. Chair and members, I hesitate to give you any definition of what dangerous means. I mean, there are, if you're talking about a lake, I mean, there are lakes that were
don't meet died.
Right. Well, so there is an aquatic life impairment, and there's one, a recreational use impairment. And so if you don't meet the recreational use impairment, you probably shouldn't swim in it. But does that mean that you will die or we just get swimmer's itch? I mean, it depends on the lake. I'd be happy to inquire with our monitoring folks, because we have 11,000 plus lakes, and we have some data on just about all of them. And I think with a couple of keystrokes, they could break that number down for you. I know I've asked for it before, too. And just because you don't meet an impairment doesn't mean that it's dangerous. So something can be nearly impaired or barely impaired, where it's just right around the margin, and we need to make a few tweaks to either keep it from being impaired or get it off the impaired waters list. We have a lot of those lakes and streams where they're not just way off the charts bad. And, of course, we have the issue of PFAS in the East Metro, which is a drinking water issue. I mean, there's lots of different categories. I noticed we even have four waters in the state, I think it's four, that are still impaired for DDT.
Interesting.
So there's a wide variety of contaminants that have impairments. But we could break that number down for you.
I stirred a question from Representative Christensen from her, probably her district.
Thank you.
Or a statement.
Yeah, well, and just, you know, I'm not a scientist either. I'm an English teacher. So, but I believe in Lily Lake, there's some sort of natural occurring amoeba or something like that was in the lake. And there were a couple deaths. So I would love to have an update. I haven't heard a real update on Lily Lake and where it stands. I've heard that there's improvements and that it stands to possibly reopen for swimming. We all swam there. It was our little city lake. Anything you can send my way about updates on that. Thanks for Leon for bringing it up. I would greatly appreciate it. And thanks much for the presentation today, Mr. Hart.
Well, thank you, Representative. I want to thank you, Mr. Gardner, for coming today. I really wanted to jump deeper into water. I mean, I really believe that the whole thing passed. I think back to the girl on dock, you know, and the sale of clean water for Minnesota was really so important. And I really believe that, you know, that helped convince Minnesota the value and help these funds. A lot of different groups like to take credit for it, but I think those ads are really what pushed it over the top. So focusing on this is important. Mr. Gardner, if you could send some of the things, I've seen some great information like We Are Waters sending out information on and then there's Bowser, I think, is, you know, had some great stories where they're working with farmers. If you could send that to committee members and then but again, I'd like to thank everybody for the discussion this morning. And I think it's robust and hopefully it continues. And again, thank you everyone for your time this morning. And if you have questions, I know, Mr. Gardner, you're available to answer those. And again, thank you everyone for joining us. And have a good day. With that, we are adjourned.